Webcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, Director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602. Or toll-free across the United States, it's 1-877-753-3341. And now, with today's topic, here is James White.
And good afternoon. Welcome to The Dividing Line. It is getting toward the end of the year, believe it or not. It is the 6th of December already. my daughter is making rumblings about having a baby very soon. And that makes it really... I'm sorry? It's a what? It's a baby rumbling. Oh, yes. Never mind. Can't hear you very well if you're on. I can hear you fairly well through the uninsulated, unfinished door, but that's the only way I can hear you. So just keep that in mind. Anyways, don't even bother with that. It was sort of fun watching some of the people in channel. We were just on the Wayback Machine was the Steve Gregg debate. And, what year was that? I don't even remember what year that was now. That was a while back, but that was interesting. Anyhow, it's 2008. Oh, okay, that sounds about right. We were supposed to do a live debate, as I recall, and then I think the church didn't like the idea that there would be disagreement. Well, that happens in debates. Anyway, welcome to The Dividing Line. It's a beautiful day outside, and it's finally going to cool off next week, sort of. If 67 is cool, I'd rather have 47, but ain't gonna. It's been a while. We did have a pretty cold winter a few years ago, but ever since then, it's.
If you need cold weather, just go up north.
Okay, all right. I'll do that. Anyways, the following has been. I feel a need to apologize for Dr. White's behavior because I am the one who brought him into our airwaves. I'm hoping that by tomorrow. You've had time to consider what he did today and how negatively it reflected on his. I had forgotten that was quite the interesting encounter, and notice we haven't had any since then, whatsoever. And there was a reason for that. Anyhow, I caught this news item, and I'm just like, oh, you. It just reminded me, many many moons ago, when I was. I had a full head of hair, okay? That tells you how long ago this was. I'm just about, I am less than 2 weeks out of hitting the big 5-0, all right? It's coming up. I'm actually looking forward to it. I am looking forward to being 50. I really am. I'm tired of being 49. I'm tired of the 40s. it's time to start getting some discounts someplace. And you've been here so long, you have blazed the path for me.
Trust me, it's not all it's cracked up to be.
It's not the new 30. Anyway, just about there.
you'll find places on your body you didn't know exist hurt.
Oh, come on. I've been doing that to myself for a long time. What
are
you talking about?
No. They just hurt. Not because you did something to them. They just hurt.
Anyway, I'm looking forward to that. And so this is... If I still had hair, this is a long time ago, but some of you know who Tom Likas is. I've told this story before, but we get new listeners once in a blue moon. Tom Likas is sort of a shock jock, and last I knew he was in Los Angeles. And he was on KFYI in Phoenix before. That's sort of where he became known, was on KFYI, and then he went over to Los Angeles. And I was on with him. I lost track how many times I was on with Tom Likas. I think it was minimally a dozen. I think it was more like 16 times, something like that. And classic example of one of those guys has an on-air persona, which is almost nothing like his actual real person. I often said that he was a geek with a gnome with teeth, sort of a geek and sort of mild-mannered. But on the air, he was this... provocative guy. Anyways, he had a representative of the American Atheist on. And his name was Brian Lynch. And he was on with some local minister, and just vile, just nasty, and oh, it was horrible. Just rah. And a few months later, his producer called me and asked if I'd be on with Brian Lynch. And I said, sure. I actually had wanted to have the opportunity because this guy had thrown out a bunch of stuff that was fairly easy to respond to. So I get there and we're sitting there. I'm talking with Tom and he says something about we're waiting for Lynch to show up. Well, he had been on the phone before. I just thought this was going to be a phone interview. He was actually in town. And so I'm like, oh man, he's going to be in studio with me. So all of a sudden this guy comes walking in. He is this little 5'2", you know, 95 pounds, sopping wet, little nothing. And he's so wimpy. He's like, hi, nice to meet you. It's a beautiful studio and you have nice weather here. And I'm just sort of like, no way. This is different Brian Lynch. Because the guy I'd heard on the air was just this fire-breathing, nasty man, and this guy is just sort of, you know, sitting there. Nah, 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 nah. Well, as soon as the microphones turned on, this may have been one of the first times I ever encountered demon possession, I think, because he just went nuts, and he would just be while we're on the air, and then as soon as the microphone was off, so where can you go around here to get something good to eat? And I'm just like, total multiple personality thing going on here, okay? I mean, even Lycus is sort of like, whoa, weird. You know, so anyway, I don't think it was on the air. I think it might have been. In fact, it might have been. But I thought it was between calls. Anyways, I think it was on the air that he just looked at me and he said, why don't all you religious people just go live on an island and leave us alone? That's what he really wanted. He wanted everybody who reminded him of God to be removed from his experience, out of the culture. Now, Brian Lynch, I mean, that was the 1980s. And you might go, just an extreme example. Well, Church cancels Charlie Brown over atheist outrage. A Little Rock church has canceled a student matinee performance of Merry Christmas, Charlie Brown, after critics complained the show was too religious and therefore violated the Establishment Clause of the U.S. Constitution. Yes, the cancellation came as the Arkansas Society of Freethinkers, who actually don't want you to be free to think. Free thinking is a oxymoron for them. Free thinkers told television station KATV they had received legal advice on pursuing a possible lawsuit against the Little Rock School District. We're not waging a war, said Leewood Thomas, a spokesman of the group. We're basically calling a foul against the separation of church and state. A spokesperson of the school district told Fox News they had absolutely nothing to do with the cancellation of the performance. They said they had consulted with their legal team and determined that the field trip was appropriate. Students at Terry Elementary School have been planning to attend a school day field trip to watch a stage version of the holiday classic hosted by the church. The event was strictly voluntary, and teachers sent home letters explaining the purpose of the trip. But it was canceled on threat of lawsuit. Now, who threatens lawsuits? Maybe somebody up in Madison, maybe? I have a feeling. Separation of church and state, meaning you cannot in any way, shape, or form even acknowledge what Christmas actually is. We already seen this in Sweden and places like that. Sweden, which is just so far out in loony land on this stuff, that they've come up with a new pronoun that's not he or she, it's in between somewhere so that we don't offend anyone. Okay, if you want to see where we're going, just look to Sweden and realize this is sheer, complete, 100% insanity. Absolute insanity. But a Charlie Brown Christmas. Now remember, there are some people who wanted to boycott the Great Pumpkin. It's the Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown, at Halloween, because it promoted bullying. And now Charlie Brown gets a black eye for being too religious, because remember, Linus does quote the Christmas story. Yes, folks, secularism is not a neutral worldview. It may be getting a pass that way, but it's a worldview unto itself, and the rabid atheist does not want Christianity to have any voice whatsoever. That is their hope, that is their desire, that is their dream, and they are working to accomplish that dream. Yes, sir.
Just for your edification, when the shopping cart does return...
Yes, when the shopping cart returns.
When the Brian Lynch...
Right after Christmas.
408.
Yes, 408.
And we'll be there.
Let me mention something about that. Some of you are probably wondering, why can't I buy anything from Alpha and Omega Ministries? Well, it's all Rich's fault. It's a long story. And obviously, this was not how we planned to do it. But if you read the blog articles, you know that we tried to upgrade some software, and turns out that our old cart, which is rather old, would not work with the new software, and we weren't aware of that, and we were only partially prepared to start working toward a really nice new setup, and so now. Rich has been working many hours getting it set up. But what that means is during the busiest time of the year, your friendly neighborhood Alpha and Omega Ministries can't sell anything. So some kind folks have already stepped up to help us, you know, make up that shortfall. But please remember us at this time of year. And, you know, we were just having a conversation about the fact that... the folks in Washington, there are a lot of folks in Washington that would love to see nonprofit tax exemptions go away. They'd love to see charitable deductions go away, all that kind of stuff. And we would obviously be deeply, deeply impacted by every nonprofit would be deeply impacted by the loss of tax exempt status and things like that. But some a whole lot more than others. And the fact of the matter is, the vast majority of our supporters ain't trying to hide excess money. Let's just put it that way. They're giving out of their need, not out of their excess. They're giving because they believe it's important for our voice to be here. It's important for a truthful response to Islam and secularism and Mormonism and Roman Catholicism and Jehovah's Witnesses and a defense of the Trinity and all these things. And that's where the vast majority of our supporters come from. We don't talk about it much, but folks, you need to realize it's the people that are running on treadmills listening to this program. It's the people who send in $10, $20, $30, $40, and $50. That's how we keep going. That's how we keep the lights on. That's how we keep the ministry operating. We do not have big corporations that dump money on us and big rich people. We just don't. I offend all of them. I'm too scary for those folks. I might say something that might get everybody in trouble. And so that's how it's done. And a lot of people make the bad assumption that because we don't talk about money and because we don't talk about things like this, that means that we don't have needs. Well, we do. And we just feel that talking about important stuff is more important than talking about that. So just a reminder along those lines.
There is one avenue for those who are trying to find things that you would find valuable. We do still have the Amazon store.
Have we ever gotten anything from that?
Yeah.
Really?
Here and there. It's not a lot, but, you know, every now and then, we, you know, basically, once we amass $100, Amazon will send us a check. So a couple times a year,
yeah,
maybe.
Okay.
But the point being, we still have a volunteer, Buzz,
yeah,
who has compiled a nice listing of books and other things that really do dovetail nicely in with what we're doing.
Maybe
here.
Maybe we'll have a way of letting people know more about that.
Right, and so amazon.amn.org, if somebody wants to go and, like a gentleman I spoke with this morning, really needed to get his hands on the Forgotten Trinity. Well, I still have that ability. He can do it there, you know, and we receive something.
Yeah, it's better than nothing, I guess.
You know, so. Yeah.
Well, just keep us in your prayers, and, if you want to help us out during this time period, obviously. Right now, everybody and their uncle's hitting you up saying, we need to end the year strong and all the rest of that. I know. Just so you know, we are a nonprofit corporation that functions because you all help us to function. So that having been said, we move on from there. I've taken the time to put the Williams Green debate together here. There's a couple quotes that I just want you to hear. I'm just going to play this one. There just seems to be such a massive double standard when it comes to dealing with Islam. Because some of the statements that Paul Williams makes, amazingly offensive. Amazingly offensive. It just seems like Christians are very hesitant to say anything as strong as he does. And they don't seem to see that, you know, that's how things work. Listen to this one line from, or series of lines, from the Q&A section. And then notice the audience applause at the end. Just check this out.
He was not someone who got required to be sacrificed like a cow or a sheep. And slaughtered. I mean, that's not what God requires of people. He in Islam, God is a very forgiving and merciful God, and he does not demand a blood payment before he can forgive people. And that's why I'm a Muslim and no longer a Christian, because the God of mercy and grace is only found in Islam, unfortunately, not in the Christianity we see today, which is based on Paul's theology rather than what Jesus actually taught. It's the religion of Jesus I follow, not the religion about Jesus, which unfortunately many Christians today follow.
Can we have a question?
So lots of folks found that kind of rattling summary of Paul Williams' apostasy very compelling. We will obviously get to that as we look through the materials, but it is sad. It is amazing. There was an excellent section. Let me see if I can. This is later on. This was Turton Fan made note of this on his blog, so I thought I'd go ahead and play it for you, so you could hear it yourself. It was one of the better exchanges in regards to the subject of this particular debate. I'm gonna play both what Williams said and what Chris Green said. So this is just one of the questions that comes up from the audience. Listen to how it went.
That Jesus died for the people he's preaching to.
Does Peter say that Jesus is God or God incarnate or the second person of the Trinity or divine anywhere?
Does say that Jesus whom you healed.
Yeah. Now, did you catch that? Did you catch that? In Acts, he knows that 2 Peter 1:1 clearly identifies Jesus as God. Now, my gut is he would do the, well, all real scholars know that Peter didn't write that. He would default back to the skeptical perspective. But he's avoiding it by just saying, well, in Acts. Well, there are all sorts of critical, skeptical scholars that don't think Luke wrote Acts either, so it seems somewhat odd to make that distinction, but anyways, just I'd point that out.
Yeah. Christ, you meant for bad, but Christ meant for good.
Yeah.
So this is
does he
not
say anywhere in that speech or anywhere in Acts that Jesus is God or the second person of the Trinity or God incarnate or divine?
Now, the second person of the Trinity, so you really expect, I mean, this man sat in Christian churches, claims to be a former Christian. You know, that's why I'm no longer a Christian. No, he was never a Christian. What bothers me about Paul Williams is when I hear Muslims making statements like this, who have been raised as Muslims. Okay, I get that. I can't expect that they've ever been taught appropriately, that they've ever had opportunity of really knowing the truth. You have to be patient. This man's an apostate. He was in a church. He knows better. He knows better than the things he's saying. So you can't view him in the same way because of this very issue. And it's a shame.
That is the subject of the debate. And I submit that he did not say that. Now, whether or not he was crucified or resurrected is a fascinating discussion.
Oh, it's a fascinating discussion, which he would never engage. I bet you he will never debate anybody on that subject. I bet he'll never debate anybody on that subject. Because he knows that every single person that he cites, Richard Baucom, for example, would all say the exact same thing, that one of the best documented realities of history is the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. He knows that. So there's got to be somewhere within his mind that he goes, I can't go there. There's just got to be.
This is supposed to be a debate about Jesus as God. Is irrelevant, is it incidental to me whether or not Jesus rose from the dead? If we worship Jesus today as God and he was a man, we are committing idolatry even.
What's the assumption there? If we're worshiping Jesus today as God and he was a man, well, if he was once a Christian, he would know and hence have to accurately represent his former faith, or be dishonest, that we recognize that Jesus was a man. He was the God-man. But the entire he at one point, talks about God cannot die. Jesus died, therefore Jesus is not God. It is so simplistic. That is not argumentation meant to communicate anything to any of the former members of his former church. That's not meant to communicate to Christians, because Christians know better. We know our faith better than that. That is argumentation for your own side. And when you're in a debate and all you're doing is going rah, rah, rah to your own side, what does that tell you? What does that say about your perspective? What does that say about your stance in regards to truth?
Which is a serious sin in Judaism as it is in Islam. And that's the issue, a debate.
By the way, idolatry is a very serious sin in Christianity as well.
Christians are trying to get off that subject.
Christians are trying to get off that subject. Paul Williams, I challenged you to debate that subject. So don't tell me Christians are trying to get off that subject. That's just, again, utterly dishonest.
Yeah. Because from Acts, here was the challenge. Does Peter anywhere in Acts say this? Here is Acts chapter 3.
Now, Chris Green gets up. He gets to comment on the audience questions as well. Unfortunately, Paul Williams' volume is lower than Chris Green's, so you're going to have to listen carefully to hear what he says. Now, let me just go ahead and read for you the text, because it is a beautiful text. I got to admit, just thinking about this text once again reminded me, and if you've been a Christian for really any period of time, you've had this experience, as long as you're one that seriously seeks to read and understand the Bible. You've probably read the entire Bible, or at least all the New Testament. And you've read certain books multiple times. And you go back to a text, and you read it, and you know you've read this, and you recall reading it, and you might even have some notes in your Bible or something like that. I had a friend back in St. Louis. I was looking at his Bible, and man, I've never seen so many notes in a Bible. It's to the point where, honestly, it's next to impossible to read almost anything in the New Testament, and there's almost as much in the Old Testament. I mean, here is someone who reads their Bible. It's great. Little cluttered for my taste, but it's great. But you read the text again, and all of a sudden, I've read these words. Yeah, I thought about these words, but there's just something that just flies out at you. And all of a sudden, the text that you've read dozens of times before shoots up your list of favorite texts, of texts that have incredible meaning to you. And here in Acts chapter 3, beginning verse 12, when Peter saw it, it's the healing of the man in the temple. And while he clung to Peter and John, all the people, utterly astounded, ran together to them in the portico called Solomon's. And when Peter saw it, he addressed the people. He took advantage of an opportunity of witness. Men of Israel, why do you wonder at this? Or why do you stare at us as though by our own power or piety we have made him walk? The God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, the God of our fathers, glorified his servant Jesus, whom you delivered over and denied in the presence of Pilate when he had decided to release him. Now, let's go through this slowly, shall we? I mean, I love teaching the word, and this is a pretty important section. Notice what Peter's doing. Peter doesn't see himself as having started a new religion or being a part of a new religion. He says, the God of our fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, the God of our fathers, glorified, and yeah, that's doxazo, glorified his servant Jesus, whom you delivered over. Paradidomi could also be translated as betrayed, but it's to deliver up, whom you delivered up, and they did something else as well. They denied him. They denied him. The Greek term is arnaomai, and that's the same term that, interestingly enough, in the last program, when someone said, if we deny him, he also will deny us. Arnaomai, to deny. So there is delivering up, and there is the denial. Before the face of Pilate, the presence of Pilate, when he had decided to release him. Now, what's interesting is, in what we're going to listen to, Paul Williams is going to make some comments. Unfortunately, Chris Green, he's under time constraints. You do this, and it would have been a little better if he had started at verse 14, which I think he did, but at verse 13, so you'd have the context. But you denied the holy and righteous one. Now, that is arnaomai. Now, it has just been said that Jesus was the one that you delivered over and denied. So, in the preceding verse, the object of denied is Jesus. So, logically, it would seem that in verse 14 it says, but you denied the holy and righteous one and asked for a murderer, a phaneia, to be given over or granted to you. So then look at the contrast that is provided. You denied the holy and righteous one. You asked for a sinner. So you had someone who was holy and righteous. Someone who was undefiled. And then you asked for a murderer. Someone who's under the just condemnation of the law. You asked for a murder to be granted to you, and you killed. What? Who kills? A murderer. But who did you kill? Tande archegontes zoes, the author of life. The author of life. Who was given over? Jesus. Who was denied? Jesus. Verse 14, but you denied the holy and righteous one, that's Jesus. And you killed the author of life whom God raised from the dead. To this, we are martyrs. Martyres esmen. We are martyrs. We are witnesses. And his name, by faith in his name, has made this man strong, whom you see and know. And the faith that is through Jesus has given this man this perfect health in the presence of you all. Jesus is the focus all the way through. But listen to that phrase. The archegon, the author of life. Now you're going to hear Paul Williams say, doesn't mean he's deity. Well, let me just ask a simple little question here. And I don't know how many times I've repeated it, but I'm going to repeat it again because repetition is the mother of memory. Don't, as a believer, allow yourself to be put in a position where you are constantly having to give an answer and not making sure that the other side has to answer to the same subjects. In other words, think about it. From our perspective, it makes perfect sense for Jesus to be called the author of life. He's the author of life in the sense that he's, well, how is he described in Isaiah 9? He's the Sar Shalom, the Prince of Peace. He is the one who brings about peace through his sacrificial death. That's how he establishes that peace. And here he's the author of life, the very life that we have, as John had put it. And interestingly enough, here's a clear connection between the substance of Johannine teaching and the apostolic proclamation of the earliest period, over against the critical theories that turn John into something else, which are, of course, repeated uncritically by Paul Williams. John, chapter 5, he has been given to have life within himself. No mere creature is the archegon tes zoes, the author of life. By his sacrifice, by his ministerial work, he provides life, yes. And he's the one who raises the dead. And he's the one through whom all things were made, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 8, 5, and 6. We exist by him and through him. So there is perfect consistency. Peter, John, Paul, no reason to try to put divisions there. But what an incredible phrase. The author of life. And what an amazing place to put it in. You killed the author of life. There's so much to be thought about there. I mean, is that even possible? It does come up in this debate. You're actually saying God died? Still, it's the same old. We'll get to it. We will have to criticize Williams once again for adopting a view of death that wouldn't have been his as a Christian or a Muslim. But there are Muslims going, well, I don't understand how God can die. Well, God doesn't cease to exist. But the God-man can give his life. That's the whole purpose of the incarnation in the first place. Doesn't mean he ceases to exist. But he is the author of life. And how, what more of a commentary could you need on the depravity of man than to think about the fact that the author of life enters into his own creation, and what do we do with him? We put him to death. Is that not the essence of the contrast between light and darkness? We love darkness. He's too bright. He's bringing light. Extinguish the light. But as soon as he says, you killed the author of life, whom han hatheos egaren ek nekron, God raised him from the dead. And of this, we are martyrs. We are witnesses. What an incredible, how could those words fit into a Muslim context? That's why I was saying, don't, whatever you do, you have to keep in your mind, they must answer these questions. If they're going to quote these texts, then they have to answer these questions too. And there isn't a Muslim alive. Okay, I'll take that back. There isn't an Orthodox Muslim alive who could call Jesus the holy and righteous one and the author of life in the context it's used in Acts chapter 3. You couldn't do it. You couldn't do it. Jesus is not the author of life for Muslims. He was the Jewish Messiah. They're not really sure what that means, as we'll see. He was the Jewish Messiah, but, you know, it says in Matthew 15:24 that he was only sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. So it's not for anybody else. Of course, that is a gross abuse of the text, as we will point out. But the point is, they could not possibly believe that this is what Peter actually said. Did Peter identify Jesus as the author of life? I can guarantee you, Muhammad was not the author of life. Muhammad wasn't the author of life, but Jesus was. Jesus is the author of life. So there's the text. Sorry about that. Started preaching again, but I have a feeling that there's a coffee mug or a tie coming with this text. I just wish I had artistic capacity. I do not. But I've got this tie in mind with this text. I just need to find someone who has artistic capacity to make it work. I can just see it in my mind. It's sort of frustrating to... I can see it, just can't make it appear anywhere. So anyways, there's the text. So now let's listen to how Chris Green presented it.
Okay. The God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, the God of our fathers, glorified his servant Jesus. You can see all that. We can go on to that if you want to. Whom you delivered over and denied in the presence of Pilate, whom he had decided to release him. But you denied the Holy and Righteous One. That's title for God, if you wish.
No, it's not.
Now, did you catch that? No, it's not. No, it's not. Really? Okay. So, I guess let me try to make his argument for him. And the idea is there can be human beings who are holy and righteous. Just as there were other people other than Jesus who were called Messiah. He's going to point that out as well. See, the Muslims have this real problem. Son of God? Well, other people are called Son of God, so it doesn't really mean anything when applied to Jesus. Well, there is Son of God. But then you have the Son of God in a unique way. There were anointed ones, but then you have the Messiah in a unique way. You have holy and righteous men, but then you have the holy and righteous one who is denied and put to death. So the idea is, on their side, their argument is, well, other people were like that, so he can't be unique. Once you put it in that sense, you go, well, wait a minute. So because there are many basketball players, Michael Jordan wasn't the best. There wasn't the Michael Jordan because there are other people named Michael Jordan that go out and shoot baskets? Really? That's the logic behind it, but that's what we keep hearing from these folks. Doesn't make a lick of sense, but that's how it goes.
And asked for a murderer to be granted to you. And you killed the author of life, is what Peter... Now, listen, friends. I was asked for evidence...
That's not evidence that he was God.
Now, did you catch that? That's not evidence that he was God. That's not evidence that he was God. Well, pray tell, Mr. Williams, what's an evidence of? If Peter viewed Jesus in the way that you say he viewed Jesus, then you tell me. Would he describe Jesus in this way? Yes or no? That's the kind of argument that has to be put to this man.
I was asked for evidence that Peter preached that Jesus was God and yet died. You killed the author of life, is what Peter says. I put it to you, ladies and gentlemen, you may disagree with what Peter said. You may disagree with Luke saying it. You may think the whole thing is a fabrication, but that the New Testament teaches it in the very book that Paul said he didn't is true.
Now, one of the reasons that I wanted to play that is, you know, I've picked on Chris Green on a couple of things. You don't turn to people in rebuttals, give them their time, et cetera, et cetera. But that was very well done. And Turretin fan yesterday wrote a blog article noting that element of the exchange itself. And he then expanded on evidences in regards to that particular text you might want to take a look at on his website. So I wanted to play that for you and sort of join that together with looking briefly anyways at Acts chapter 3. And I don't know, it's not a quote-unquote Christmas theme, but I think there is, in my mind anyways, a real connection between thinking about the description of Jesus. And I love Van Lees. I love the folks at Covenant of Grace Church. I wrote to Van and said, you know, Van, I'd really like to have a copy of what I did Sunday night in MP3 to post it for the Christmas season. And, of course, Van's response was, I'll send you a copy. In other words, it's coming by snail mail because that's the most advanced mechanism of transmission that Van has, I'm afraid. Not like, oh, here, I'll file attach, an MP3 for you, you know, that kind of thing. No.
At least the guy can use a computer.
Well, yeah, I know. Anyway, love those folks. But I do hope to get that stuff. But I did a study of Isaiah chapter 9, and especially just that incredible text. I love doing that around the Christmas season. But it just strikes me, there's just something so incredible to think about the author of life being born, entering into human existence. You know, there's one thing that you cannot dare not notice about that. If you want a reason to recognize the sanctity of human life, there it is. There it is. I mean, secularism does not offer you any reason whatsoever to honor the sanctity of life. None. You are the random chance result of the collision of molecules. You have no transcendent purpose. Stalin was just doing what Stalin was doing. There's nothing right or wrong in the secular worldview on that outside of opinion polls. And that's what's so sad about our society. Selling its birthright, selling its worth out to the despicable, shallow worldview of secularism. It's just disgusting. But you want a reason to recognize the sanctity and worth of human life? God not only created it, he took the time to enter into it to redeem it. There you have a foundation. There you have a reason for opposing the culture of death. Breaks my heart. Absolutely breaks my heart. I was struck with it. You know, my son was born 7 weeks early. And in 1986, that was still pretty early. It's always pretty early, but you know what I mean. And I'll never forget driving home from the hospital. One of the toughest things about my firstborn's birth was that we had to go home without him. That's tough on a mom. A first-time mom, you don't want to go home without the baby. So he was in neonatal intensive care for 3 days. He didn't, you know, and in comparison to some of the other babies in there, he was huge. okay? I mean, my wife was 2.5 pounds at birth. And that was, well, I better not tell you when that was, but you can sort of guess. Close, real close there, really close. Almost went over the fiscal cliff there. but I recognized it, the reality. I was driving home, and I recognized the reality as we left him there. We had visited him in his little incubator and stuff like that, that as there was all this attention being given to him and technology being used to keep him alive and to monitor him and all the rest of that stuff. Yeah, Turton fan just said 29 years ago. Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. Unfortunately, my son is 26, so that would really cause a bit of a problem at that point. But anyway, all this technology being used to keep him alive. And only a few buildings down, babies in better shape than he could be chopped up in the womb and sucked out, and no one would pay the price for that murder. Well, don't get me wrong, folks. That price will be paid someday. In eternity. Judgment will be done. Judgment will be done. But you want a reason to believe in the sanctity of human life? The incarnation proves it. And it may be one of the reasons why there's a difference between how Christians and Muslims respond to blasphemy. Some Yahoo in the hills of North Carolina burns a Quran and Muslims kill people. Christians don't do that. Christians don't do that. And that's because we believe God became flesh. The Logos became flesh and dwelt amongst us. See, theology matters. That sounds like the name of a new radio program that is going to be premiering in January on WMCA Radio on Long Island, hosted by moi. Yes, indeed, we are actually going to have, I believe, the half hour immediately before Renewing the Mind by R.C. Sproul. And I think program's going to be titled Theology Matters. So we'll be letting you know more about that as we get to it. But I better get to our phone call here so we have enough time to answer the question. And I don't even know what the question is other than Mac has a question. Hi, Mac. How are you?
Hello, Dr. White. How's it going?
Doing good.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I've been speaking with this Muslim friend of mine for the past 3 days, and he brought up this objection to me. He cross-referenced Numbers 23, verse 19, and John 7, verse 9 through 10. His argument was that in Numbers 23, verse 19, God is saying that he's not a man that he should lie, and he's not a man that he should change his mind. And he cross-referenced that with the John verse, which basically shows Jesus telling his disciples that he was going somewhere, and then he changed his mind and went somewhere else. So he just he said that Jesus is disqualified from the title of being God. So
well, actually, I wanted to get your... just a couple of things. First of all, Numbers 23:19 is one of the texts that we use in witnessing to Mormons and others. It's one of the many texts that God is not a man that he should lie, nor a son of man that he should change his mind. Has he said, and will he not do it? Or has he spoken, will he not fulfill it? So the point of Numbers 23:19 is that God has a purpose, and he's going to accomplish that purpose. It is not that we do not see, for example, God proclaiming destruction upon a city and then relenting of that. From our perspective, it seems like God changed his mind only because we don't see his eternal decree and we don't see what all of his purposes are. But the point is that God is not the type of being that lies and is changeable and things like that. Jesus does not lie or is not changeable in John chapter 7. Going up to the feast, John 7:8 says, go up to the feast yourselves. I do not go up to this feast because my time has not yet fully come. Having said these things to them, he stayed in Galilee, but when his brothers had gone up to the feast, then he himself also went up, not publicly, but as if in secret. To go up to the feast was a public celebration. You went up. In fact, there are the ascent psalms in Psalm 121, Psalm 120, the songs of ascent. It was a part of, it was an open public thing where you engaged in the singing of the psalms and all these things that you would do along the way. That was what going up to the feast meant. Jesus did not go up to the feast in that way. He went up quietly, possibly by another route. He did not go up with the throngs of pilgrims. He did so, as it says, and John even has to explain it, then he himself went up not publicly, but as if in secret. In other words, he didn't go up in the way that he had told his brothers that they were supposed to be going up. He went up in a different way. It was not the way that people normally did it, and he had a reason for it. What does it say? His time had not yet come. His hour had not yet, it says in verse 8, my time has not yet fully come. Jesus knows that if he's going to come up in that way, that he is going to attract a huge crowd. I mean, John chapter 7 is right after what? John chapter 6. What happened in John chapter 6? He had to send the crowds away because they wanted to do what? Come and make him king by force. And so those, and where would he be coming from? The very same place where all these people were. So if Jesus openly does the procession to the feast, that would be the norm. Those same people are going to be gathered together once again. The messianic fever is going to be there, make him a king by force. And the whole issue is going to be forced ahead of the time and not in the way that God's sovereignty had intended it to take place. There has to be other things that take place first. And so Jesus has not, quote unquote, changed his mind because he is not going up to the feast in the way that is he told his brothers to. He has not changed his mind. He has not lied. There is no contrast in any way, shape, or form between what is said of the nature of God as being unchanging in Numbers 23 and what Jesus did in John chapter 7. That wouldn't even work in regards to the fact that, people try to say in regards to Numbers 23, well, but God relented and didn't destroy this place, or look what God did with Jonah. And, you know, Jonah said, I knew you wouldn't do this, you know, things like that. That kind of argumentation really is a stretch to try to get around the fact that the authors of these texts intended to communicate something that is consistent and is harmonious. And the problem is the only reason your Muslim friend doesn't believe what both Numbers 23 and John 7 say is because he believes the Quran. And the author of the Quran did not understand these things and therefore taught him incorrectly.
Okay. All right, Dr. White, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Was that too much or did that give you what you needed?
No, that was perfect. Appreciate it.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot. God bless.
God bless.
All right. There are so many arguments and texts like that. In fact, we've got about 4.5 minutes. Here's a good example of it. This is why I love this program. I love Audio Note Taker because I know exactly where this is. It's marked in blue. I can go right there. Listen to Paul Williams. This is another one of the standard, let's abuse the Bible, throw it out there. And again, when I hear a person who's been raised as a Muslim doing this, I go, all right, I just need to correct them. They never have heard differently. But when Paul Williams does it, it just strikes me as grossly dishonest. Here's the clip.
For example, Jesus was quite clear. All you non-Jews here, I'm sorry that Jesus wasn't sent for you. He said, I'm only sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel.
So, there you go. Jesus was not sent, but Muhammad, they like to contrast it, and the very next phrase is...
Well, the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, said, but God said in the Quran, I'm sent as a mercy to all the world. So we don't...
Now, you actually could argue against that from the text of the Quran. There are texts that would indicate that this is a much later Islamic presentation, in essence. But leaving that to the side, how would you respond to that? How would you respond to that? Matthew chapter 15 was being talked about. Matthew 15, 22. And a Canaanite woman from that region came out and began to cry out, saying, "Have mercy on me, Lord, Son of David. My daughter is cruelly demon-possessed." But he did not answer her a word. And his disciples came and implored him, saying, "Send her away, because she keeps shouting at us." But he answered and said, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." But she came and began to bow down before him, saying, "Lord, help me." And he answered and said, "It is not good to take the children's bread and to throw it to the dogs." But she said, "Yes, Lord, but even the dogs feed on the crumbs which fall from their master's table." Then Jesus said to her, "O woman, your faith is great. It shall be done for you as you wish." And her daughter was healed at once. They don't tell you the whole story. The whole story is, this illustrates the exact same problem with the "who touched me" argument. Both are gross, simplistic, silly misreadings of the text. Jesus wasn't confused about who touched him. He was bringing out her faith. Jesus isn't confused in this situation. He isn't being mean to this woman. He's bringing out an expression of her faith. He was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. That's right. He didn't go off to Greece. He didn't go off to Rome. That wasn't God's purpose. But are you seriously going to suggest to me that Matthew, who wrote these words, intended you to understand the words of verse 24, the way that Paul Williams just used them? This is the same book that ends with Jesus. "All authority has been given to me in heaven and in earth. Go ye therefore..." Where? Oh, only to Jerusalem. No! Go into all the world. Preach the gospel. It is simply dishonest to take one text in Matthew. Now, I know that most Muslims don't know about Matthew 28, 19 through 20. They've never made the connection, if they've ever heard it, and they've never thought, well, that's the same author. And most Muslims would go, well, yeah, you shouldn't interpret an author in contradiction to himself. I mean, they wouldn't like that if we did that with Muhammad, right? But Paul Williams does know. He does know that, to quote this one little phrase, and to ignore what's found in the rest of Matthew, is absolutely deceptive. It is dishonest. It is wrong. I don't understand it. I can understand the person raised as a Muslim. I can get that. I don't get this level of deception. Don't get it at all. Be ready for that one, though. Because, oh man, many, 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 many people will quote that one not knowing the rest of Matthew. And you might be able to help them. You might be able to help them. Thanks for listening to The Dividing Line today. We'll be back, Lord willing, on Tuesday to continue the process of doing what we do on this program. Thanks a lot for listening. God bless.
Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracks. Join us again next Tuesday morning at 11 a.m. for The Dividing Line.